Welcome to the Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Wright. Join me as I have conversations with fascinating medical experts as we discuss a variety of compelling topics. We aim to not only inform you, but to empower you, instilling confidence along your journey toward optimal health. This podcast is brought to you by Brentwood MD. Located just south of Nashville, Tennessee, Brentwood MD provides best-in-class concierge primary care. To learn more about our innovative approach to primary care, visit our website at brentwoodmd.com. On this Spotlight edition of the Future of Medicine podcast, I'm excited to be joined by Dr. Jennifer Kerr, an allergist and immunologist with Heritage Medical Associates in Nashville. Dr. Kerr received her undergraduate degree from Miami University in Ohio. She received a master's in science of neurobiology and physiology from Northwestern University. She received her medical degree from the Medical College of Ohio before completing her medical training in Tennessee. She completed both her residency in pediatrics and her fellowship in allergy and immunology at Vanderbilt University. Dr. Kerr has been practicing since 2009 and specializes in food allergy, asthma, allergic rhinitis, and eczema with Heritage Medical Associates. Join us as we discuss the role of allergy testing, some common food intolerances, and how to approach managing symptoms of environmental allergens. We hope you enjoy this conversation. Well, Dr. Kerr, thank you so much for joining me on this Spotlight edition of our podcast. As you know, professionally, we've known each other for probably more or at least a decade.
Yeah, I think so.
So you've been immensely helpful to many of my patients. And so I'm really excited to kind of do a deeper dive into some really common topics that affect many, many people.
So, happy to.
As I introduce you to our audience, if you just want to tell me a little bit about kind of what led you through your medical training to land in allergy and immunology.
Yes. It actually was not a part of the big plan when I went to medical school. I, prior to that, had had my master's in neurobiology and physiology, and I was very interested in neuroscience. And so then I went through the different phases in medical school and realized I didn't really love neurology. And so I found my way into residency in pediatrics, and then again went through that progression of which subspecialties in the world of medicine do I enjoy. And then I came across allergy, and it was fascinating and interesting, and it's a field where you can make a lot of patients feel better.
Yeah.
And so it was very appealing to me, because it was intellectually interesting, and yet you could also do a lot of good in one day.
That's really great. And actually, I'm so glad you say that, because as we record this episode here in April in Middle Tennessee, it is environmental allergy season. And so a lot of people aren't feeling real well. So I wanted to kind of do a little deeper dive into that.
Sure.
And obviously, you likely see some of the more complex cases of environmental-based allergies. Yeah. So what are some of the really common symptoms that you run into with patients in your office? What are they experiencing? And then we'll get into kind of how we unpack testing and treatment for them.
Sure. So the basic symptoms of most patients at this time of the year, because it's the spring pollen season, which is going to be mostly our tree pollen and our grasses. The tree pollens usually start mid-February. They were later this year, and trees are usually mid-February, April, and May. The grass pollens are usually April, May, in June. And most of the patients during those spring seasons will have a lot of eye drainage and itch, sometimes even eye swelling. The nose will typically struggle with congestion, drainage, mucus in the throat. The patients that we see kind of more urgently during this time of the year will have significant trouble with their asthma, their breathing. So more than just a mild cough may become wheezing, significant trouble breathing. So there's a whole spectrum.
Well, and with that, and especially like you say, with the season that can go over the course of months, when people don't really know what they're allergic to, they just know they have some sort of spring allergen. Tell me the value of getting to the actual allergen specifically that they may have in terms of the importance of it, but then also how do we test for a specific allergen?
Sure. So you can test in two different ways. You can test with a blood test or a skin test. The skin test, which is what we typically do in our office, is still considered the gold standard in medicine. So it's considered the most accurate way of evaluating a patient for allergies. And we find it helpful because you'll meet patients that say, oh, it's the spring every year, and then may ask some or inquire further about other symptoms and find that they have symptoms at other times of the year. And when you do the testing, you may find, oh, it's actually outdoor molds that they're allergic to, or that it's dust mites, and that there is mild grass allergy there, but probably the baseline trouble that they have with an indoor allergen might be amplifying their symptoms overall. And then the value in knowing what those allergens are helps you to control it better.
Yeah.
So just identifying, how do you lessen the exposure to that? Do we put a dust mite cover on your pillow? Mm-hmm. Is it actually maybe your pet that's causing these, you know, sort of symptoms? And then bringing in outdoor pollen or any of the above. So identifying the allergen will help us to more accurately avoid what's contributing to the symptoms.
Okay, great. When you mention gold standard testing kind of being the skin testing versus blood-based, kind of tell me what's the breadth of things you can test for in each of those, and when are they complementary to one another?
So the breadth is similar. So you can test for a variety of trees, grasses, weeds. You can test for indoor and outdoor molds, dust mite, pet dander. You can test for all variety of foods on both. Okay. There may be a broader panel of food allergens that you can test for in blood work versus skin testing. Skin testing may not have some of the less common spices and things like that, for instance. In our office, we'll typically do the skin testing if we can, because it's the gold standard, and it's actually more economical than the blood test is per allergen.
Okay.
But both can test to a broad variety of antigens. They can test for trees, grasses, weeds, indoor, outdoor molds, dust, pet dander. They can test for a variety of foods as well.
Okay.
The blood testing would allow us to test sometimes for some of the less common foods that may not be available on the skin test. The skin test can certainly test for wheat, egg, milk, soy, peanuts, tree nuts, variety of other common foods, fruits, vegetables, and common spices as well. So there's really quite a lot there. We'll use them complementary when something doesn't make sense. So let's say you're seeing a patient that struggles with the spring pollen season. You can't find an answer on the skin test, and I'll send a blood test to see if I could find it that way.
Okay.
Or vice versa. And that may sometimes happen even with food. So sometimes you'll meet a patient that's had a serious reaction to a peanut and their blood test has been negative, and they'll come to the office and we'll do a skin test, and the skin test is robustly positive, filling in that gap of knowledge there. So they can be complementary. I would say it's not common. It's also not very rare that they could be discordant, meaning the the skin test would find something or the blood test would find something that the other one did not.
Gotcha. Yeah. And when it comes to blood testing, I know some of the panels that I will order here to just try to get the workup started, hopefully be helpful to someone like yourself who's an expert in the field. You have kind of the broad IgE panels, and then you have a few IgG panels. Kind of tell me a little bit about the difference in those two. And then I see on the report sometimes kind of a class 0 to 6 type of threshold of positivity. Tell me kind of how you would interpret those in the setting of obviously the clinical history.
Sure. So the clinical history is the most important part of any allergy evaluation. I think that's important to note. We will find that the testing can be somewhat binary, meaning that once, let's say it's in regard to a food, and so once it's positive, the next question is, well, what level of reaction has the patient had? So, and this conversation would be in regard to IgE testing. Okay. And so let's say a patient's had a peanut reaction and the reaction was really quite severe. Their skin test might be a 20 millimeter wheel. When I'm measuring the size of it, it might come back on a blood test as greater than 100, or it might come back at 0.1, and it's just very low positive.
Okay.
But if that patient has had a severe reaction to that food, then that's a very serious allergen. Mm. And we would base the level of concern about that food based on the clinical history.
Gotcha.
And once the test is positive, whether it's skin or blood in that setting, we would say simply that it's here, you have a serious food allergy, and let's address that further. Mm. The scales can be different depending on the antigen. So mm-hmm. when you look at the scale on the blood work for egg, for instance, if it comes back as a value of 2 for IgE, that's very different than a value of 2 for peanut.
Okay.
In terms of the predictability of future reactions and such. So the readout that you would get from the lab is actually going to grade them all in the similar ranges, mm-hmm. class 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. But there's research that looks at those values for each food independently.
Okay.
So wheat, for instance, can come back with an IgE of, oh gosh, even up into the 70s before it's actually got about a 50% chance of causing an allergic reaction in a patient.
Yeah.
So there's really quite a lot of variability in that.
Yeah.
As for the IgG testing, that's been associated by some with food intolerances.
Okay.
The data on that's rather weak, though, so we don't typically rely on it much. And this can get into a discussion about what is a food allergy versus intolerance. But the IgG testing mm-hmm. is not, unfortunately, very useful to us as initially folks had hoped. I think one of the best analogies I can make with the IgG testing is when we've treated a patient for venom allergy shots, they've had a serious reaction to a stinging insect such as a bee or a wasp, mm-hmm. and they've come into the office because they've passed out or they've been covered in hives when they were stung, and they want to know what we can do about that. We would then test them. We would evaluate, do you have an allergy to that stinging insect? And if they do, then you could offer a course of allergy shots because they can be very effective mm-hmm. for stinging insect allergy in terms of reducing future risk with a sting. There were studies years ago that used to show that an increase in the IgG antibody to that stinging insect actually was proof of tolerance. It's, you know, it's sort of ironic in this world of IgG testing being sold to a lot of patients, telling them that this is evidence of inflammation to this food, when we've known that it's a biomarker in the past is actually that there's tolerance developing to something. Mm. So a lot of the IgG panels will come back with foods that are in the patient's diet. They'll hit your common foods, in particular milk and egg and wheat, which are commonly part of the food intolerances too. Mm-hmm. And so patients will notice a change when they take those foods out of their diet, but mostly because it's identifying the most common foods.
Yeah.
That cause those intolerances. So I don't use IgG testing whatsoever, mm-hmm. really just sticking with the IgE testing, and only in regard to if those foods have triggered a more serious allergic reaction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's a good one. Thank you for that explanation, because it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but especially when it comes to kind of the class of the result for the blood testing, you don't really necessarily focus too much on that.
Correct.
The clinical history obviously carries the most weight. And then with IgG testing, not very useful.
Not very useful.
At all. So that's great. That's great. Well, thank you for going through that. And actually, thank you for getting on into food allergies, because that one, I know you're very passionate and knowledgeable about.
Yeah.
And then I think culturally, in the health culture that we have, I see a lot of questions about it, a lot of curiosities, even more recently into the gut microbiome and how certain intolerances and maybe food allergies can affect that. And that can then trickle into many more aspects of their health picture. So let's actually go back and something you referenced, kind of the difference between an allergy and an intolerance to food.
Sure.
And tell me a little bit about the difference, but also why it's important to know the difference.
Sure. The definition of a food allergy is very general, actually. It's simply an inflammatory or an immunologic reaction to a food. So that's pretty simple, and it actually would encompass potentially a food intolerance as well as even an anaphylactic risk food allergy. Because if we're talking just very generally an allergy, if this is just an immune response to a food, we then would secondarily sort of identify which type of an immune response to that food. I think traditionally the word allergy, though, is associated with anything that has an anaphylactic or more serious reaction to a food that is on what we call the IgE-mediated spectrum of food allergy. And so that's typically how we utilize that word. However, allergy does just simply mean an inflammatory reaction to a food. The food intolerances, however, we do see a lot of patients that have symptoms along those lines and have a lot of questions around that.
Yeah.
Now, to back up, though, to IgE-mediated food allergy. So that's when a food enters the body and then creates an allergic cascade that can result in symptoms such as hives or swelling, trouble breathing, feeling like you're going to pass out or actually passing out with low blood pressure, more traditional serious anaphylactic type food reactions. And those are typically caused by peanuts and tree nuts and shellfish and sometimes fish. We'll see them from milk and eggs and younger children typically. And those are the type of food reactions that we would ask patients to carry an epinephrine injector for and to read labels to avoid the food allergen. When it comes to a food intolerance, I wish that I could describe what inflammatory cascade is happening in that, but we really don't know. I think that medicine is still... there's still quite a gap in our ability to explain what's happening in the body when somebody has a food intolerance. The symptoms can be quite debilitating, though, of food intolerance. And I'm sure that's why patients are asking more about it, because they will oftentimes complain of stomach pain, bloat, IBS type symptoms. Sometimes it's fatigue, and brain fog. And they'll find that they take these foods out of the diet and their symptoms resolve. And that's something that medicine's still looking at to figure out. I get asked, is this really real? And my response is typically that when you look at the compliance of a diet for weight loss, you've got about a 0% chance of sticking with that, right, over time. But let's take a patient that has a true food intolerance to wheat or to gluten, they're not very motivated to turn, you know, down a cinnamon roll, for instance. And patients that have discovered that level of reactivity stick to that diet at a very high percentage. And so to me, that tells me there's something really going on there. It's a completely different spectrum of symptoms and inflammatory type reaction, but there's something there. And if they feel better doing that and they have a positive relationship with food and can still get nutrition in other ways, and then that's okay in my mind. Unfortunately, it is a clinical diagnosis, though. There's not a perfect diagnostic test, whether that would be doing an endoscopy or scope, looking on the inside for different cells, or whether that would be doing any blood test or skin test to look for the foods.
Well, that's really relieving to me to hear you say that, because I really, with many of my members, we deal with more of that food intolerance picture, where it's like they can just tell that they don't feel right.
Right.
And it we'll get into kind of the difficulty in isolating which food or foods may lead to that. But, you know, they'll come to me with the symptoms and clinically, like, there's something here, but I can't explain it. You know, the testing may be normal. Their their allergen workup may be negative. But you can just tell there's still something there. And so it's nice to know I'm not the only one that can't explain it. So true. And actually, let's unpack that a little bit. How, when somebody comes to me and I can just tell from their story that, yes, something in their nutrition is leading them to feel overly fatigued or have gastrointestinal symptoms or brain fog. And I try to tease out maybe a certain food group or specific food, and I just can't. Where do you start in that type of workup?
So I usually start with how much fiber is in the diet. Because when we think about how the gut works, you know, you alluded earlier to the microbiome. We have all these microbes that live in our gut, and the entire lining of our gut is our immune system and our nervous system, and all of these microbes that are living there are able to talk to our immune system and our nervous system. And how those microbes eat is becoming increasingly important. And this may ultimately parlay into some of the research that's looking at food intolerance or even truly food allergy, actually. And some of the best food for those microbes is fiber.
Okay.
So I start there because the diversity of those microbes seems to be issue number one that we need to tackle. And in order to get those microbes to increase in their diversity, fiber seems to be currently one of the most important things. Mm. And most of us have pretty low fiber diets. You know, that if you were to look at how much fiber is in many people's diets, if they have a typical American diet, you're probably looking at maybe 10 grams a day or something quite low. And we really want to aim for about 25, maybe even 30 over time. And that's going to be my question number one, because before I take away foods or do an avoidance trial where we might say, let's take out wheat from the diet or milk or dairy from the diet. I'll start with, let's just switch to a very healthy, high fiber, plant forward diet. Truly a Mediterranean diet is usually what I would recommend, because in that diet, there's really quite a lot of fiber. And in that diet, it's not all Greek salads and chicken kebabs. It's actually a lot of legumes. It's a lot of beans. And that's where you can get a lot of fiber into the diet. And so
I love that thought, because you do have to separate the Mediterranean diet from the Mediterranean restaurants.
There's
a little overlap,
a little different.
But not always the same.
It's definitely different. So I typically would say to a patient, let's aim for 25 to 30 grams of fiber in your diet per day, and see how your gut feels after a month of that, you know, before we go taking big categories out. Because sometimes when you look at these avoidance trials and when you look at avoidance diets as being helpful, it's because a lot of good things were put in. And so what is helping here is an important question in my mind. Is it a removal of a food causing inflammation, or is it just a lack of some healthy foods and enough fiber in the diet? And so I like to start with that first. And if they're still having symptoms, we dive in and we typically just simply go through an avoidance trial where we'll say, let's take out, if the patient wants to do it more difficult for a short time, really pare the diet down into some basics and then add things back in one at a time. Or maybe it's more simple for them to take out a single food for several weeks and then put that food back in, because we're not dealing with a perfect test and there's a lot of placebo that can be involved in this. I will at least say it's important, if we take a food out of the diet, to assess how we feel and then to put it back into the diet to assess how we feel. So you don't want to take something out and just leave it out. You want to try both sides of that coin.
And what's your progression of like the food groups that you may kind of select to eliminate first? And even like you referenced, maybe going in really intentionally and deeply and then kind of peeling back slowly. Kind of guide me through that approach as well.
So I'll typically think about wheat and dairy. Milk are probably the two most common food intolerances. So we'll typically start with those, maybe adding egg in there, sometimes the meats even, or sometimes some of the other grains. Typically, if we pull out something as broad as dairy or wheat, a lot of times patients learn from that. They'll say, oh, I've just had a bunch of oat or corn in my diet, and that seems to be bothering me just as much as, you know, I as when I had wheat in my diet. And they have a bit more insight because they're starting to feel better and can notice things. So I typically would start with that.
Great. And how long do you recommend for like an elimination? You know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks? Like, what's long enough to then reassess success or failure?
That's a great question. We don't really know. But what I recommend as a best effort is about 2 weeks. I feel like we also have, I think 4 weeks might be a more accurate way to assess, but I think that life is short and it's difficult to avoid something for 4 weeks and have the patience to not try it back in or see how you're feeling.
Especially if on day 15, you're not seeing a difference, no doubt. Those last few days would be really rough.
Absolutely.
Well, that's really helpful. Just kind of that framework and guidance. You know, and actually I know the challenge of elimination is a real thing too, to really be able to read a food label with enough knowledge to cipher through the marketing and to get down to the ingredient list. And so I think it is worthy of us even taking a moment to talk about how do you really practically guide people in an elimination diet to avoid, you know, some wheat creeping into their foods, right. And especially if they do eat out where they're not in control of the ingredients like they would be at home.
Sure. So I think step one is if you're doing an avoidance trial from a food intolerance standpoint, we don't have to come to it with the same level of intensity as if you may have anaphylaxis to that food. Mm-hmm. So if you are eating out and you feel better eating gluten-free, let's say, then order a pizza with gluten-free dough, but don't stress if it's been made in that same facility or might have sat next to a pizza that was not made with gluten-free dough. Mm-hmm. It's very uncommon to have that level of sensitivity with food intolerances. Yeah. So you can be a bit more gentle with that. When it comes to reading a label, then patients with food intolerance will gain from patients that have anaphylactic risk to foods because mm-hmm. there are labeling laws. So there are laws surrounding our labels for the major food allergens, which would be milk, egg, wheat, peanuts, tree nuts, fish, shellfish, and now sesame. So all of those foods are required by law to be included on the label and secondary to the inclusion in the broad text when you're reading under that label is at the very end, it'll say contains, and it will have to say contains one of those foods if it was anywhere in the label above that.
Gotcha.
So someone avoiding wheat, for instance, would be able to look to see simply, does it say contains wheat?
Gotcha. Thank you for listening to this conversation. I truly hope you found it useful. You can find out more about today's episode and discover additional resources at BrentwoodMD.com. Be sure to check out all of our other content that we've created by searching BrentwoodMD on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. If our content has provided you with value, it would mean the world to us if you subscribed to the show and left a review. This helps us ensure that more people, just like you, can find our content so that they can begin optimizing their health. To learn more about our concierge services that we provide to our members, visit BrentwoodMD.com. We'd love to meet you. This podcast was for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should seek the advice of their own trusted medical professional.